Are there any questions or anything to share? Okay, so as we go along, if there's any questions or anything to share, I hope that we'll start to break the ice at some point. I'd like to give a talk that we could call Tiger Snake. There's an old Indian story. There was a prince named Ram. And he urgently needed to meet with his teacher, who was the teacher of the whole family, Vasishtha. But he couldn't go himself to request the presence of his teacher, and so he asked his brother Lakshman to go. And Ram gave his brother a ring. This is my ring, so Vasishtha will know I really urgently need to meet him as soon as he can. Come. And Lakshman took the ring and rode off on this mission from his brother king, brother prince, elder brother. And in India still today, even being 1 year older than somebody else gives you the right to lots of respect. One of my closest friends in the world is 10 years younger than I, Indian woman. And we've lived together for years, and we've been through a lot. But still, she has such a hard time saying anything that might sound a little bit demanding or critical to me. Whereas another friend who's just 1 month younger than she, 1 month younger than my Indian friend, gets all the, can scrub out the dirty thing under the sink, that sort of, if you've been an Indian, you know what I mean. I won't go into it. So Lakshman was on a mission from his elder brother, so he was feeling very important. And he rode as fast as he could to Vasishtha. And he got to the ashram, and he called out that he had the ring of Ram and that Vasishtha was needed. And just like I heard yesterday someone say, we don't call out in England. We wouldn't just call out, hey, come on, hurry up. Especially in this house. It wasn't an appropriate way to ask for the presence of the teacher in that culture. And so Vasishtha did come out and said, oh, you can just toss the ring in there. And there was a clay pot on the ground next to the road. And Lakshman was probably even more upset that his brother's ring would just be tossed into a pot. But he did. He tossed the ring of the king into the clay pot on the side of the road. And there was a sound of metal hitting metal instead of metal hitting clay. And that got Lakshman down off his horse, which is what he should have done in the beginning. And he looked in the pot and he saw a pile of king's rings all in the pot. And his face just turned white and his mouth fell open because he didn't know what was going on. But he started to have a clue. This wasn't the first time the same exact scene had played out. That Lakshman had come with a message from Ram, with a ring from Ram, and had been in such a hurry and so full of himself that he hadn't just gotten down off the horse to ask. And so in the story, the idea is that the pile of rings from eons, from lifetimes, again and again, repetition of the same story. And already today, we've had the chance to meet in our minds that repetition. There's already been that same thought over and over again. There's hardly been a thought that you didn't think before. And so, what's a way for learning to happen? What's a way for there to be enough space or pause that, without thinking about it and without putting ourselves down, but there could just be where the body gets off the horse, gets out of its hurry and importance and somebody-ness. And meets the deep wisdom inside you. Your own teacher in there, who keeps waiting, keeps coming to the door, keeps showing where to throw the ring. I have a friend who's also my permaculture teacher. So a kind of ecological, sustainable design. And he's from Australia. And he told me a true story, in many ways true, but it happened to him. And the story starts long before the sort of crisis moment. The story starts with him not being able to stop. He noticed himself unable to stop. And he was living in the rainforest, and so there was a lot to do. He was living in a really rustic way. And things in that rainforest grew so fast that there was always a lot of clearing to do, just to have a little bit of sun or space. And lots of eco-protests and actions to organize and be at. And he saw that he was making himself ill mentally and physically, but he still couldn't stop himself. And even in the way he was telling the story, there was this unstoppability. And there's something in the story that I want to bring out right away. There's something in that quality in him, a sort of fire and a passionate sort of action that is really important in him. It's his gift and it's also his destruction. And I think that we have, each of us, traits or qualities or something that are that. They're our best, biggest gift, exquisite. But just this tiny way that it's tangled and it's also destructive to ourselves and others. The very same trait is a traitor and also our only way. And so getting to know ourselves is so important. We're not trying to find out, like, what's that bad guy or whatever in there, the monster or the bad gal or whatever, so that we can destroy that. Because right there is also our way. And we need to go with that unique set of qualities or traits in a kind of initiation after initiation, refining and getting more fluid and steady with it, so that it's free in us to be powerful and at rest. So my friend was first complaining about how he couldn't stop and how that was destroying his life and his relationships and his body. But that wasn't really what he thought. He was really telling the story about the tiger snake that came into his house one day. But he did leave in that very important part about being unstoppable and it hurting. And somehow he noticed that the tiger snake came into the house. And he noticed that the tiger snake, very venomous snake, came closer to where he was in the back of the house. And he saw it again, closer. And it's also curious here, in terms of this word initiation. He saw the snake coming closer towards him in his own home. And there was not despite all that unstoppable energy, there was no action to take care of himself in a space with a venomous snake, a deadly snake. So it's that way we've been in those situations where we saw something coming and we didn't do anything about it. But afterwards we know we saw the snake there, and then we saw it there, and then we saw it there, and we saw it there. And then it bit. It bit my friend. And that stopped him. It didn't kill him. He could only lie down for about 6 months. And I don't want to go in that direction where we try to make everything so meaningful or to make it anybody's fault. But the snake, by biting him, did, in fact, in that story, save him. It actually saved his life by nearly killing him. So we have to be really careful, just as careful as if there were a venomous snake in this room, which I suppose there isn't. I suppose there's not very many around here. In India, there's a very helpful saying about anger, that it's like being in a room with a venomous snake. If we really feel how that would be, we would just be very, very, very aware not to touch the snake. But in this case, to be very careful of how the anger can bite us, how the anger can come against us, the blame of ourselves. The hatred of our lives, of how unpredictable our lives are, of how unruly. And I would just like to suggest that sometimes when we're in silence together, something about being together in silence, even more than being alone in silence, can allow something that's been deep within us, that's old, that would repeat, but it surfaces. And if we can really meet it, just let it surface and say, how good that this is surfacing. It's only surfacing because it's like that old house that we used to live in and think was me. It's starting to come apart. And so there's some space and some light to see by. The walls are coming down. And something that needs to be met has surfaced. And sometimes it's just a matter of warmth and patience and being present with that. Other times it can be helpful to have a radical redefining of what we think happened, like with the tiger snake. So we could still say that must have been scary and that must have been hard and frustrating to go from one day unstoppably doing way too much to the next day for month after month unable to do anything. That must have been really hard. And I'm so glad you're still alive, that you just didn't overdo yourself to your death. And we have to be so careful that we don't use this as a way of blaming or putting too much, like personifying the snake or the event or whatever, or trying to be grateful to someone who hurt you when really you feel afraid of them or you hate them or whatever. But the event that happened, thank goodness it happened. Sometimes that's the case. Thank goodness it was possible to have enough acceptance in the case of my friend to go through that initiation of being unable to be effective and engaged outwardly for 6 months. We could all right now think, what would be my version of that? What would be the thing that would be nearly unbearable? And to find that sometimes, not always, sometimes only, there's medicine when we fall into some place we never would have gone on purpose. And so we don't have to say, oh, thank you, snake, or how good. Some people might, and that's fine, but that's not what I'm saying. How good that through the unexpected, there was a gap in all of that repetition. So that, for example, an unstoppable quality could go rather deep down inside and not only out. And we can even start to get the hang of this so that we don't need to wait years and years until it's at a peak point and a snake bites us is the only way to stop. Every day we can feel for the unexpected. We can feel for the unexpected in almost everything, even in the repetition. That sense of like, oh, the mind again wants to go there. Oh my goodness. Again wants to say how terrible, miserable, poor I am. Or how much I have to do or whatever. Even repetition can be awe-inspiring. And so it's kind of like learning how to be bitten in a different way. Being bitten by the kind of fierce unpredictability, the fierce uncontrollability, unownability. Of our own experience. Because otherwise, don't we seem to just be trying to get away from that very same thing? We just seem to be kind of like slightly turning our back to that unpredictability thing. Oh, I'm going to be on retreat and in such a wonderful place. And then if anything unpleasant comes in such a wonderful place, it's somebody's fault because it can't be. Of course it can be. Of course, in this house, always. Not only this week. The unexpected happened every single day, every single night. And isn't it a wonderful opportunity to be in the signs of, among the signs of wealth, and to really get that? It's not a protection from the unpredictability of life. Sometimes things still really suck. And sometimes what's beautiful isn't the brocade. We could then really come inside and get into the fact of how much in a way, it's a paradox, how constant the unpredictability is. The unpredictability has a constancy. It's constant. Yesterday, I called it unownability. And so this is where our inner gesture could really matter. Just turning inwards with this, not away from this. And it takes some softening and loosening to really get how much change is going on. Not by our hands, not by our intention, not by our say or control. It takes loosening and softening and kind of liquefying, and also, if we can say, steadying. I'm almost tempted to make up the word steadifying, liquefying and steadifying. The steadifying is where we come into the fact that things in the psyche are in movement only. Then we could stop expecting the psyche to provide us with the steadiness. We could stop expecting the mind to provide us with the steadiness. And that just doesn't, it then stops giving the invitation to the controlling. The control freak no longer gets invited. It will certainly burst in uninvited, but it doesn't get invited. When we let the flow be the flow, of thinking and feeling. And having so much sky here and so much going on in the sky here can really be helpful. It's never, ever the same. Not once. And it seems to be fine, like not a big deal. So similarly, inside, things never ever once being the same, can also be fine, ordinary, doesn't need to be sort of overwhelmingly exciting. And somewhere we already know this, so it's kind of getting off the horse and getting into ourselves. It is simple and it is scary, and that's why we don't. And so if we could also further take away the expectation that we shouldn't be afraid to come inside our own lives. We will be. We are. And that's okay. That's not the end of the world. And it's not the end of the path. It's only when we expect myself not to be afraid, when I see I'm not in control, when I see that everything that I relate to comes and goes by itself in its own timing. Everything. I could rather expect there to be some fear at some point. At least the body, let it have its fear. Please. And when we let it have its fear, then the fear does its thing and is finished. It might take days, weeks, months, years, but again, it's not up to us to decide that. And isn't that wonderful? There's not some timeline that we're supposed to do, catch up to, or stay behind with. There's no way to know how it's going to go. Any questions or anything to comment or share so far?
Just about you saying at least the body lets it have its fear. So you mean making a distinction between body fear and some other fear?
Yeah. Good. Could you hear the question? She's asking, I said body fear, and am I distinguishing between body fear and another kind of fear? So I was not sure if I would go into it, so it's good. So simply we can say, yeah, between body fear, which is body-mind fear, but simple, fear of actually being without ground and experience. And then the psychological fear of, oh, what if I look? What if I feel? What if I actually know what's going on already, that the snake is actually in my room? That's a more psychological. And normally we have both. But it's true, the body fear, I call it that because it sort of makes it easier to accept and also easier to let it have its own life and then flush out. And so rather than necessarily being able to or needing to address that body fear, which is just an actual fear, an actual, when we're in an emergency, there is stress hormones and it's helpful, that kind of fear. Then the whole system starts to recognize, oh, I didn't die. Actually, well, in a way, I did die, and it's okay. The body didn't die, and something died, and this is kind of better. So, okay, accepted. And then it happens again. So it's just a moment of where nothing much is happening, and boredom. Oh, my God. So we're not talking only about some really, like, way-off ultimate experience. Probably somehow in different ways everyone today had some kind of experience of, whether it was like, oh my God, six more days of this, or some kind of flavor of facing our lives, of actually being in our lives in a new way. Good enough.
Yeah, well, I was wondering about, fear that's accumulated. That.
Okay, so the other fear that's not
in the moment,
fear of dying, which we are, in a way, dying in that moment. So it's appropriate that that fear comes, and then we learn that we can die and stay alive. The accumulated fear, that's a good way to say. So I call it psychological fear. That could sound tricky or judgmental or something. I think it's all about tenderness. And I spoke a bit about this on Sunday. So maybe that's why I forgot to go into it today more. If we can hear that alarm system as a simple asking for tenderness, and still know, though it's a simple asking for tenderness, it may not look simple, of course. It might look like fighting or being gone or being needy, depending on the level of trauma. It's not prefabricated. It's not a ready-made way to know how to let tenderness get in. So that's where discovery is needed, together. It's a together thing. And so we need each other for that, and we also have each other for that. And also, it doesn't mean we can't do some on our own of developing the qualities of tenderness, kindness, softness, at-homeness. Allowing the vast majority of our practice to be practicing feeling those subtle feelings in the body, in the mind, in the footstep, in the thought, in the, et cetera, eventually, starting with body, usually. If you have a really hard time feeling your body at all, then you start with the mind. You find a statement in the mind that resonates with kindness or truth, and you let the words remind you, and it's like ringing the bell. And because we're not making it up, we're not just adding something, we're not like trying to add kindness and put that on or stick it in. It's more like kindling or something. We put something in so that something can light. And then there's a brightness. And gradually we get used to that brightness. We gradually get used to, and it, really we do. I can say from my own experience, from terrible insecurity and self-hatred and fear and panic and so on. To continually giving public talks. Why? And it's fine. And it's an act of love. And it also doesn't matter if I would be nervous. It's okay. But funny enough, I was just remembering the beloved friend, Christopher Titmus, who will often say, giving a talk, it's nothing different from brushing the teeth at this point, sort of thing. And that just came to mind at the beginning of the talk because it feels so good to be together rather than pressure or whatever. I didn't bring my floss, but... Any other question or comment? Anything to share?
When you were saying about the trait in the traitor, I found that really interesting, about how something which can be your way can also be your unway. Where do you find the balance there? Mm-hmm. What's the tipping point, makes it to become a traitor?
Yeah.
But not a traitor.
Yeah. It feels like what I notice inside and outside, a certain, I would use the word stubbornness. So maybe we feel somewhere how that those traits or that trait, so maybe someone is very disciplined or very light-footed or whatever. And maybe there's some intuition that that is so precious and probably wasn't always welcome. And so, but then something gets hard around that, like, you're not touching my light-footedness. And it, as at the same time, it starts to become a strategy rather than just a bubbling up. It becomes mine instead of life's. And so I think if we give a little tiny bit of space around and also enjoy it in ourselves, which it can help enjoying it in others, to start to, it's so deep, it would be almost really hard to know what our own is. So you might start by reflecting on people you know. And it's more like getting a taste in your mouth than like something you could write down necessarily. Or you'd see almost out of the corner of your eye rather than when you look straight at them. And then the same for yourself. And so then it's like a question of whether trust can go deeper, that really what I love about this is that it's life's. And so may it keep bubbling up. If it keeps bubbling up, it's not my concern. So we take away the, gradually in situations where that's, we could say, safe, where we're not going to be kind of blown away or forced to do the opposite or whatever.
Okay. So it's kind of, if you cling onto it, like you're scared someone's going to take it away, that's when it starts to get a bit.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so it's part, there's not a one answer, but it's partly that we would also naturally want to be in wisely in situations where that can flower and be of benefit. And also that we're free to be in situations where that is not so apparently welcome, but so what? But also that we don't have to, it's not an armor that we're not fighting with it. It's not a weapon. And so there's somewhere between being protective of that juicy, precious, unknown, what is it thing. And also gradually that it's so not my own, it's so much life bubbling up, that it can be welcome, unwelcome, flowering, latent. It's a deep friendship with ourselves. And in such a deep friendship with ourselves that life is included in that and the self dies. I mentioned last night the flight from Iberian Peninsula to these islands. And I mentioned the river and that just mouth. And then we started coming over land and then water and then land and then water, and it gave another really beautiful feeling that's also part of our path. Really feeling the feeling of moving from one ground across a chasm to the other shore. Actually allowing ourselves psychologically to die, to actually accept a new shape that we can just hardly feel, that we know is good, not like right, wrong, good, bad, but it's just, But it's usually that much more light and open that it's easy to feel exposed and want to have some shell again. And so the practice of noticing when we want the shell, but no. Something deeper is that openness. Let's not cover it up. That's more home. Jay Krishnamurti even said, and I love when I'm putting the notes for a talk together, and then I have books with me, and I'll say, all right, what do you got for me today? Wendell, nothing? Okay. Denise, nothing? All right. Okay, JK, Jay Krishnamurti. You cannot live if you do not die psychologically every minute, was his statement. And he means that we would experience inside how it is, that it is coming up and going away, coming up and going away. There's not a stopping. It's actually experiencing that movement, endless movement, happening by itself. And not trying to land there. Just noticing that's not a place that we could land. And perhaps there is some kind of sense of landing in our lives. It's a kind of love of life. But equally, it's an unlanding. It's a losing roof, losing walls, losing ground. Anyone have a question or anything to share? Please.
I mean, because I kind of really get the whole idea of impermanence and everything constantly changing and everything constantly moving. And I feel like on a visceral level, I really experience that a lot. And it can be quite frightening because there's nothing to hold on to.
There,
yeah. But I just guess that, you know, if everything is this moving thing, where is the still?
Mm-hmm.
And is the still or never going to be the same twice either?
Yeah, that's the conundrum. Yeah, good, well put. And in your experience, how is stillness?
Fleeting.
Mm-hmm. But when it is, for a flash, is there anything you could report in your body or in your experience?
I mean, I think that thing about that love of life thing, that kind of can be quite overwhelming, that kind of just, yeah, feeling really connected with everything, but very fleeting.
Yeah. Good. So that's a good clue. And also a good reason that there's no rush. It can feel so overwhelming. Even my own love of life. And it is a process of the system getting accustomed to that much voltage, partly. And whenever it comes and it is just barely bearable, or maybe even it isn't, but it's not bearable for that me that I was, but it's still here. And it's a rediscovery of now, whoa. I just experienced I'm not what I thought. And that's that other sure thing. And still, the two things, it's not necessarily a kind of one-time landing. But if you just keep tuning into the quality of stillness, even in that fleeting moment that happened once, you experienced it. We all did. Somehow, in each our own way, the quality of stillness kind of can speaks. Even in memory, it can speak. And we could come back into the body and invite that or feel it. Where I felt some kind of, as if I was thigh deep in grass around here, and or a smile somewhere in the torso. Or just as heavy as snow, whatever. And then that could be enough of a response for the question, rather than letting the question and its worry go on and on. Just, there might not be an answer in words for where is the stillness in all that movement. But if we know that in all that movement, there isn't the stillness. Another clue is where there's all that movement. So, for example, sound and body we've been playing with these days. The receiving of that happens by itself without our effort. Sometimes the me is present with that perception, sometimes not, but the perception still happened. It's very interesting. So I'm distracted, but then I could wind back, how did I get distracted? Oh, that was that sound of that dog or that bird or whatever, and then I started to think about that. But we could let that bite us in a positive way, like, who heard the bird that then distracted me and knows that I was distracted when I was busy being distracted? It wasn't me that could wind that back and remember what got me going, me. Everywhere there's this positive bite of aliveness. But it's not that helpful to think much about it. But if we can get that sort of shock feeling of who knew, who heard. And then not keep it over in some sort of container of where we put our shock. Because usually there's also a process of disentangling that positive bite of awakening to the aliveness, being in touch with aliveness, not our idea of it, but the disentangling that from the sort of accumulated shock and fear. That's another part of our long-term process that just, it requires tenderness. So simple recipe, but complex ways to find. Which is fun. Let's remember, it doesn't have to be taken as a, oh. We get to discover so many ways for tenderness to come in and to come out. And so not just the shock of, oh, it's not me as I thought, and it's not the world as I thought, and things aren't as I thought. Not just that death of what we thought we are. But partly there can be a sense of a quality that's as if an underlying stream that feels quiet, though it's streaming. There could be a feeling of an underlying openness where it feels there's okayness. So I love the phrase of John de Ruyter, deep okayness. And also, as I mentioned before, this quality where if we can use the word love, a love of life that's beyond me and what I like in life and what I don't like. Thank you. Anything else?
Somehow what you said about remembering, like the stillness from before, so somehow I feel that that's just so hard, or just seeing like within one day how many times it can go like between more aliveness and something good, and then the sense of just being in something so difficult, or just the sense of like, what's the point, and
mm-hmm.
how to.
Yeah. If we can take the negativity less seriously, we tend to orient ourselves as the viewer. I'm the critical viewer, and the negativity is as if like home. And so when I'm in that, I feel as if I'm seeing correctly. And if we just have it be more wide, that, oh, there's that voice is on. So because that voice is the critical voice, is more practiced and more culturally acceptable than like passionate love of life and juiciness. It's not very culturally acceptable. It's time to practice letting the other side be home. And then still, whenever possible, like the wide as home. The other side is feeling at home, feeling joy, feeling lightness, feeling no demand, etc. So when the mind is captured into the criticism, it's not a good time to assess how is it going and how does this work and does it make sense? Is it worth? Of course it's not going to be worth doing according to that. Of course not. So we know the answer. If we want that answer, we can go there. But it is a learning process to notice, oh, look, I'm believing this again. And we can start to be interested in why, where did I go into that as if it would be trustworthy when it isn't. There's a great story that traveled from Africa with the captured slaves to North America, and about a snake. And I'll do it in as mini form as I can. I don't know if you know over here the Brer Rabbit stories. Do you? Oh, okay. So it's a Brer Rabbit story. And one of the animals, maybe it was rabbit, I don't know, was walking along and saw a Brer Snake, Brother Snake. And Brother Snake said, oh, it's cold today. I'm really cold. You have a nice big warm pocket. Could I just cozy up in your pocket for a little while, get warm? And let's say it's Brer Rabbit. Brer Rabbit says, oh, no, you're a snake. I know you'll bite me. So I'll just be on my way. Oh, I'm so cold. Please just let me have a few minutes in your pocket. I'll be seeing you tomorrow, Brer Snake. I'm on my way. Oh, please, Brer Rabbit, just 1 minute. I promise I won't bite you. Okay, come in my pocket. You promised you wouldn't bite me. And Brer Snake says, and rightly so, you knowed I was a snake when you put me in your pocket. So with the criticism, if we can have a lot of forgiveness for how many times we think it should go in the pocket, we will keep doing that. But we can also learn to hear, oh, please, I'm so cold, in a different way. Maybe there's another solution. Look, there's a patch of sunshine right over there. And I think also that we're not feeling so easily triggered into feeling responsible for doing it right. So I gotta take care of that poor little cold snake. So also with our path, like, oh God, this, I'm not getting enough of what I want. Something must be going wrong. But a wide view that really has no clue, really we have no clue, how often it might be incredibly necessary and helpful for us to experience these different aspects of what seems to us negative and closed or positive and wide, up and down, wise and repetitive. It is part of the process. And so kind of resting back in sense of humor and not having pockets. Okay. I'd love to end with a poem. Part of a poem. And I'll just again mention this is a Wendell Berry poem, and he's in his 80s in the United States, still alive. And he was a beatnik poet in New York and then went back to his homeland in Kentucky, the southeastern United States. That's not so dissimilar from this kind of landscape, hills and green and woods. And lives there still with his family. He's also an eco-activist. And often mentions his long time, half century long time wife, Tanya, in his poetry. And on Sundays, he would take a day off from farming and walk. And so these are the poems from those days. The book is called This Day. And this is a poem from 1997. I'll just read the first part of this. The lovers know the loveliness that is not of their bodies only, though they be lovely, but is of their bodies given up to love. And I'll just read it one more time. The lovers know the loveliness that is not of their bodies only, though they be lovely, but is of their bodies given up to love. May all beings rest deeply at peace as lovers of life. Lovely and giving up everything into that love. May our practice and lives be dedicated to the momentum towards liberation for all, including ourselves.